Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Peak Prosperity Featured Voices podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is November 28, 2018. And today, we're going to be talking with Charles Hugh Smith about his latest book. Its title is Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic. Hey, not a minute too soon. America teeters on a precipice right now. Certainly, if you watch your feed on Facebook or Twitter, it's like this imminent demise. But it goes back further than that, right? We know that our government in the United States is really captive to special interests and big money. The Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission decision by the U.S. subprime court. Yes, I said subprime and I meant to. Was a truly awful, horrible, no good, ridiculously bought and paid for decision that accelerated the downfall of democratic processes and citizen control of the elected parts of the government. But was that really it? I know some people say that, you know, that was the moment. Here to discuss with us the idea, though, that it's deeper than that, that there's no single decision or fix or tweak that is going to really get at the issues in a way that could give us a future we could believe in. We've got Charles here. Charles is a very prolific author and blogger. He runs the site of2minds.com. He's a frequent contributor to and guest on Peak Prosperity. Hey, all around great guy as well, personal friend too. Charles, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Chris. And thank you for being able to discuss these topics today that are often lost because, of course, our whole culture is short term, right? The political system has a cycle of every 2 years. The economy is basically every quarter. And so to talk about issues that have taken decades to play out, it's like, what?
Yeah, I know. So we'll try and keep this short anyway. No, just kidding. So Pathfinding Our Destiny. In this book, you make the claim, let's get right to the heart of it, that the crisis that America faces isn't just political. You say it's structural. Take us through your thinking here. What do you mean by that?
Okay. I think if we, the starting point for me is that we should look at very complex systems, like the way we look at ecosystems, right? Mm-hmm. Which is we look at them as systems dynamics, and then we're looking to see how evolution and adaptive pressure builds and generates responses within these complex interactive systems. And so, I think that an ecosystem is really the best metaphor or analogy we have for our economy, which has, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of participants, and all doing various little things that that create inputs that then impact, you know, other feedbacks and so on and so forth. But you know, we so if we look at our economy as like a system, then there's inputs and then there's processes and then there's outputs, right? And if we just look at those in sort of large chunks, we see that much of our inputs are social, what we might call social constructs, right? They're not really like, we're not really talking about physical laws like gravity or something like that. We're talking about a social construct which says the only way that we're going to survive and prosper is growth, right? And what is growth? It means consuming more resources and more goods and services, right? And without growth, we die. That's the basic input, the social construct we live in. And within that construct, there's another one which we've talked about many times, which is since we don't have enough money in cash, currency, to do all this wonderful stuff, we got to borrow it. And that's perfectly fine because we're borrowing to grow more and we're going to be able to pay all the debt we've accumulated in 400 years because we're growing so much faster than our debt. And so those are the two sort of social constructs that we have. And then we have a political system, which is becoming increasingly, as you say, tied into money. Now, people have always said, like, from 100 years ago, you know, money is the mother's milk of politics. Money and power have always coalesced around political power, right? But in the last, say, 70 years, post-World War II, the central governments and central banks of the world have grown immensely in their centralized power. And one of the theses I'm proposing in my book is centralization itself is now the problem. And we've been told for 400 years that it's been the solution. Just centralize power and wealth into tighter and tighter control, and then that will somehow solve whatever problems we have.
Well, so this idea that we have these structural issues, and you know, how many could we really point to? I will tell you that I think structurally we have a broken voting system in the United States. But I like this, I could go on and on. Obviously, the money system is broken by design because it's designed to be exponential, and we could have different money systems. But the one we have says got to keep growing, and we got to keep growing by whole percentage amounts all the time. And obviously that has a systemic sort of a problem at its root. So when we look at this, though, you mentioned ecosystems, and they have positive and negative feedbacks, right? It's things that keep things in balance. So, you know, too many foxes, well, they eat all the rabbits, then the foxes starve, and then the rabbits come back. So the little, you know, positive feedback loops and negative feedback loops. In the political system, there were supposed to be checks and balances, which would be the equivalent in this metaphor of those negative and positive feedbacks. But those checks and balances really, I think, are just so missing in action. And I did mention the Citizens United v. FEC decision there by the Supreme Court, which, by the way, I love that one. You know why I love that one? Because it was 5-4. Oh, it was so close. 5-4. These five voted for it, these four against it. And then later, Kelo v. New London, where property rights were taken away. Oh, it was 5-4, but it was a different 5 and a different 4. It's always like, oh, we're so close. But if you track what the Supreme Court's been up to, they've been slowly removing those checks and balances and tilting the playing field towards government power, whether it's even in the case of Kelo v. New London, that's just a municipal power, right? They're like, yeah, they have rights over property. Not at all clear where they found the constitutional basis for a local municipality having the power to seize your property for eminent domain for a better use. That was a stretched decision. So as we look through all of this, I can make a case for why we have a structural problem with the money system based on its inherent mathematical design flaw problem. But what I just raised with the Supreme Court feels to me like a different process and a different problem. How are those connected, if they are connected at all?
Right. That's a great question, Chris. And my basic answer is that they're connected through the dynamic of centralizing power as the solution to whatever problem exists. And so, in other words, in the Great Depression era, then the Keynesian solution was, well, let's eliminate all these all the falderas of markets and hundreds of banks, many of which have failed, and let's just centralize all this banking power in a handful of one central bank, right, with a handful of folks who will then set policy for all the hundreds of millions of citizens and every financial institution in the economy. And so this sort of idea that command control was the solution, I think that is what's feeding that cultural narrative, is what's feeding the political and financial concentration of power and wealth. And so, when the nation's at war, well, let's just centralize all the power, into the president and his top advisors. And if there's a financial crisis, then let's centralize all the power so we can have a handful of folks deal with that decisively. And so what these mechanisms do is they destroy markets, right, which in small scale have benefits, right? Open markets, transparent markets of buyers and sellers, at least at a small scale, that works. And then it destroys the political process of checks and balances, as you say, because I think there was a study that came out a couple of years ago where some sociologists studied the decisions that Congress had made and concluded that they basically ignored the general public's interests 99% of the time. And so, yep. And so when you claim that we're a democracy and yet the ruling organs of control, you know, the Congress, legislature, and the courts, all of which now ignore the public good or the public opinion, then it's really hard to claim that we're still a democracy. And so that's why I say the final fall. We've already fallen, as you pointed out, really far. There's not much left.
Well, right. And so let's, you know, I guess I love the definitions, you know that. So when we talk about democracy, what are we really talking about? Because I think people, in my judgment, in the United States, falsely believe that they have a democracy. And I think, you know, for like the gold standard, like full on democracy is every vote counts. And not only does it count because your voting system captures it and you have the ability to audit that system to verify the results, right? So you don't have to trust them. The votes also count because the electorate is informed and is casting a vote that's actually worth something rather than a bot vote or one that's ill-informed or misinformed. So on that second point, you know, I can look at the structural failings in both the educational system and in the media conglomeration and structure in the United States and say there's a very badly informed electorate out there as well. My judgment, you know, people can disagree, but the gold standard democracy would have, you know, full representation, every vote counts, and you have an informed electorate. What do we have today? You know, in my view, it's very much not a democracy, if only for the reason that you just mentioned, I mentioned the front end of democracy, which is how the votes happen. On the back end, you would want those votes to mean something in that the will of the people was represented. And you just mentioned a statistic, which is 90%+ of all decisions and laws and things and acts that get passed by Congress are against the will of the people. They're for other purposes and special interests. So do we have a democracy at all? I mean, is there one here to save?
Yeah, it's a very good question, Chris. And it, to some degree, there's this strange phenomenon that parallels the financial system, where the appearance is presented as the reality, right? Like we're presented with GDP growth, and that's the appearance of growth is supposed to translate into actual prosperity that's spread amongst the masses, which we know it's not, right? And in the same way, we have an election so that it creates the appearance of democracy that's really not backed up by reality. There's another point that I made in the book, which I'd like your feedback on, which is our system of governance, broadly speaking, is all about advocacy. You know, in other words, like some group is supposed to form. It could be citizens who are mad as heck and not going to take it anymore, or it could be a corporation, or some group will form and advocate for some action by the government, right? And mm-hmm. So it's this competing interests of advocacy that are supposed to turn into a big stew that somehow generates you know, regulations and laws. And so that's supposed to be a competitive battle, right, of various advocacies. But what this system fails to do is consider the social good. You know, in other words, if there's just a bunch of competing interest groups, which is basically what American democracy is, even at its most fundamental level, well, who's advocating for the common good? And of course, we find that no one's advocating for the common good. And so the common good is completely left out of the picture. It's like who wins the advocacy that benefits themselves and their allies. And so we've lost a sense of, well, what is the common good?
And let's take an example of that. I think that's maybe no more starkly illustrated than in the U.S. sick care system or healthcare system, which is an amalgam of all these different competing interest groups, right? Which in theory is supposed to work towards a common good once you average and sum everything out, right? So you've got your hospitals and you've got your, you know, plan administrators and insurance companies and doctors and patient advocates, and somehow you put all that mix in and you should end up with something approximating the central limit theorem of what people want. And we don't have anything of the sort. Of course, you know, on a dollar adjusted outcome based basis, the United States is far and away the worst country in the entire world, spending the most and getting the least in terms of outcome. So when I look at that system right there, is to me, that's a perfect example of what you were talking about. The common good would say, we want to have a system that ultimately is fair and equitable, and people deserve access to healthcare when they need it, quality healthcare, and all of that other stuff. But we don't have that, do we?
No, you're absolutely right. That's an excellent example. And you mentioned the media before, and of course, again, this intense concentration of power into the hands of an ever smaller group is also visible there, right? Six media companies control most of the media in the U.S. It used to be six banks, but now I think it's down to three or four. Control most of the financial system. So, and this we see this in one sector after another. You know, Facebook dominates social media, Google dominates search and ads, and so on. And this makes perfect sense in the system we have now. In other words, like, well, this is really efficient, you know, and it's very profitable. If you can establish a cartel or a monopoly or a quasi-monopoly, then you can just raise your prices and people have to pay it. And it's profitable. Everybody wins, right? The shareholders win. The managers win. The public, they don't have a choice. And so I think this sick care is a perfect example, as you say, because it's like all these so-called competing interests, all they do is basically strip the carcass of whatever money there is, and delivering actual health care, well, that's like secondary at best, right? Yeah.
Well, this speaks to the idea, though, that if there isn't a common good that's based on things like what's right, what's decent, what's honorable, what has integrity, what matters, you know, will, you know, for the next generations, things like that. What I mean, as we triangulate around this topic, it just appears to me that the common good in the United States is money. And if you can make money at it, it's kind of a laissez-faire Wild West. You know, if you can make money at it, anything goes, right? Oh, are you making something that kills insects indiscriminately? Go. Are you making money at it? Go for it. Oh, do you make cluster bombs, even though those are kind of outlawed everywhere, but we can sell them through, you know, some back channels? Go for it, right? Whatever it is, it seems to be okay. Practically every religious text there is talks about how the love of money is the root of all evil. Is that maybe a common element in all of this? This is just money and power running to its natural Romanesque conclusion.
Well, I think you're right in the sense that that was one of the topics I was trying to explore in the book is the initial conditions of a system that's sort of, we call it teleology, right? It creates its own end state, you know? So if you create a system with the initial conditions that you have here in the U.S., like you say, money is everything, it's the arbiter of all value, then you're going to get a certain output, and you're not going to be able to change that output unless you change the initial, you know, conditions. And so... But I want to toss out an idea that we seem to have even degraded in the last, say, 40 years, in the last two generations, back when we were younger. The nation seemed to coalesce around the idea of protecting air and water. And even a conservative president such as Richard Nixon felt moved by the general sense of a common good. And so laws were passed. And efficiencies were mandated, and as a result, here two generations later, the air quality and water quality in the U.S. is considerably better than it was 40 years ago. But we seem to have lost that ability to coalesce around something that's really obviously in the common good. And as you say, the impact on insects, which has a huge financial cost, as we all know, through pollination and so on, and yet even that can't get any traction. Even though it has a huge financial impact, but have we lost the ability culturally to agree on anything regarding a common good?
Well, that's a very interesting idea, and let me riff off of that common good. There's one of the more horrifying things I think I saw come through our education system was something called Common Core. And this was some sort of new educational something or other, clearly designed by a committee, you know. So it had the trunk of an elephant, you know, the body of a snake, you know, wings. It's just like this crazy thing. And it's inarguably a failure, and statistically and quantitatively. But meanwhile, there are countries that do this whole education thing very well. And somehow we've lost that ability to coalesce around the common good, to even say the emperor has no clothes and say, yeah, no, that's a really bad idea. But, you know, I would think that if anything, the Think of the Children movement always seems to have a lot of power behind it. You know, when it comes to something as obvious as making sure that the next generations are properly educated, we seem to, in the United States, have lost the ability to have what I would consider to be a reasonable conversation, which includes it's equivalent to saying, hey, there's no bugs hitting my windshield. That's a problem. Let's organize, you know, let's have some energy around that topic, to saying, wow, the United States is way behind all these other industrialized nations in terms of every measurable output of you know, test taking and whatnot. Maybe we should do something about that. I sense almost no traction on any of these things. It's just it's almost there are two things that happen. First, people just shrug their shoulders and go, ah, what are you going to do, right? The second thing is that there are defenders of the system as it exists, right? They like it that way. And you had, in a recent blog post, you wrote, quote, "For our political and financial elites will cling to their centralized power, doing more of what's failed, even as civil society unravels." That's kind of at the higher level. But I mean, you know, people unable, you know, people defending the school system churning out, you know, substandard students by every international measure. Why is it that people will cling to things that are arguably, provably not working?
Right. And I think you've really gotten to the core of the system, which is what you might call entrenched interests pursuing their self-interests. And, mm-hmm. and that's really what we're talking about here. And that, as you said, we all understand human nature, right? There's a lot of moving parts in human nature. We can be compassionate. We can be empathetic. We're not simply rational economic machines grinding through everything to maximize our profit, although that's the way our financial system and economic system is set up. It's like there's nothing in human nature except a overriding urge to maximize personal gain at by any means available at any cost. We don't care, right? That's kind of the way the system is set up. But as you said, politically, there were checks and balances on that kind of rapaciousness. And we seem to have, as you say, lost that. And I think that what the key structural difference is that when you ruthlessly centralize power into monopolies and state cartel kinds of structures where there's a handful of players control the whole system, you've eliminated the ecosystem. You've done the equivalent of planting a monoculture and then spraying it with Roundup, so there's no insect life. There's so you get a great crop, you know, for a few cycles there. But of course, you're destroying the soil. You've destroyed the ecosystem around it. You've created food that's no longer nutritious, and on and on and on. And so we've created a monoculture economy and political system, if you will. And the solution to that, I think, is a massive decentralization of power and capital, right? And that's not going to, that means that would require rebuilding the society and the cultural narratives and the economy from the ground up. Because right now, anything that attempts to decentralize wealth, power, and capital is snuffed out.
Well, exactly. And we are discussing the book Pathfinding Our Destiny with Charles Hugh Smith. And I know, Charles, you didn't write this as another problem definition book, because I'm going to turn now to the subtitle, which is Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic. So it seems the subtitle, would I be wrong in suggesting it's saying all is not yet lost?
Right. I think we're in the final stage here of collapse, as we've been discussing, meaning that we don't have decades. We've already burned the decades where we could have reformed the system. Now we're down to, I think, a matter of years. And so that's where I use the term final fall. And I think that my choice of the word pathfinding my idea here was, hey, look at, we have to explore a lot of different solutions. It's not like we can just go back to the same old models from 1940 or 1840 or whatever, you know, like, oh, let's go back to pure capitalism, or let's go back to communism, or let's go back to socialism as it was defined, you know, in 1870. I don't think we can just rely on these old models. I think that the world is now too hyper-connected, and things have advanced beyond where these models from basically the 19th century can be applied, and we can hope that or assume they're going to work. So I'm looking for us pathfinding, like taking what works in a practical way without trying to slap an ideological solution on a really complex system. And if you go into, it's fascinating. I'm sure you've read even more studies than I have. But if you go in and study where there's an ecosystem that's failing, right, that it's breaking down, and then the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers or somebody comes in there or some agency, they often try to get a grand solution, right? That usually ends up being even more disastrous. And it turns out that what seems to work is little things where you're introducing more diversity, and letting things play out. And in an economic sense, we'd be saying, if we had 1,000 regional banks that had nothing to do with the central bank, they weren't controlled by some, you know, higher agency, that they would probably introduce a lot more competition and innovation into their local markets than 3 mega banks. And if we, you know, and so that's kind of like the model I'm suggesting as our last best hope.
Well, I love it. The whole decentralization, I think, is going to be a wonderful direction to go because, you know, so for instance, I was just reading just yesterday about how, and I forgot who was the author of the book that this article was based on, but the idea was that you could track the loss of civic function with individual engagement with things like Rotary clubs, Elks clubs, you know, Granges, whatever those things were, churches even, so that localized small group sort of participation where you get a feel for how things get done and what happens, and it's at a scale you can wrap your arms around. And, you know, politics is always messy, particularly at the local levels and all of that. So that loss of engagement really seems to be a defining feature of our time. And I think what you're arguing here is that's not a one-way trip. That, you know, progress is not all of us, you know, locked in our living rooms watching Netflix and, you know, staring at our 4x5-inch, you know, smartphone screens, right? So there's an arc to this. We swung really far towards down this path of not really paying attention, allowing things to sort of, you know, persist as they will. There's nothing that centralized governments love better than people who aren't really paying attention to what they're up to. And it does take a lot of fighting to sort of stem that tide. Are you suggesting here that there's still time for people to, say, vote their way out of this? Or are we going to have to start doing this, you know, exploring, as you called it? Are we going to have to start just sort of, you know, pathfinding and making mistakes and trying things out at the local level and hope that something sticks here?
Right. I think I'm kind of proposing two possibilities. One would be that we have I confess immediately that this is sort of pie in the sky, but in crises, whether they're financial, political, social, or all three interacting, they offer opportunity, right? In other words, people start questioning, well, gee, you know, is this really the way we want to go? So one possibility would be to have a national kind of discussion about what's our national strategy. In other words, as a nation, are we going to pursue this path of centralization and advocacy of special interests and let the system collapse as a result? Or could we actually have a conversation about a renewed national purpose, and that value system change would then start defining our political and economic choices, as opposed to just these narrow, self-interested advocacy groups just trying to maximize profits or gains. So we could have that conversation. If we don't have that conversation, then I think we're going to see a decay of things that people take for granted here, Like there's always going to be gasoline at the gas station, that the money is, your money is going to still be more or less worth the same amount 6 months from now. And that your pension will show up in all of its glory. And all these things are going to start falling apart. And for all the reasons we've talked about many times, then we'll have a second opportunity to change things, like to decentralize power and capital and let people in the local communities actually have a say. Because part of why, as you say, the loss of engagement is people realize they're powerless. You know, you go to the meeting, you go to the bike club, you lobby the city, and then nothing happens. And it's all like, you know, it's like the system has been centralized to the point where people have dropped out, partly because they realize they're powerless. So as things unravel at the centralized level, then power starts becoming possible. Control and investment, these kinds of things become possible at the local level, but only when the centralized, quote, solutions collapse.
Now, could we argue maybe that centralization has already hit its zenith and is headed down again? Because we would note things like, oh, the riots that are happening in France right now, or the Catalonia breakaway, Brexit, Trump, all these other signs that say the populace is getting restive again. And that's because in this quest for centralization, the economic oxygen was really vacuumed out of the room of the regular people and put into this little tiny chamber where a very small number of elites live, and they've been breathing fine. So is that is this something that sort of self-corrects on its own? And if so, you know, I would guess maybe you're arguing here we want to do that on our own terms rather than other terms. Other terms rhyme with things like civil war and
right.
Things like that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that I guess my main point is that every economy, every society, every culture is a social construct, right? And as we've talked before, that it's based on a value system, right? In other words, and which defines like priorities and incentives. And so if we can consciously choose another set of values that's more towards a social good and the common good, and we're transparent about the incentives that we want to create, then I think we have a chance. But if we don't tackle it on that systemic structural level, then it's just going to run to fail.
Well, you know, I know a lot of younger people, I'll define that as under 30, who really feel like the system's already past saving, that the generations before them made some really horrible, bad, no good decisions, spent a lot of money, piled up a lot of debt, don't have a lot to show for it, that kind of stuff, and aren't really too positive about how things could possibly work out here. Is there a generational aspect to this conversation?
Undoubtedly. And being an old baby boom geezer, I don't make any claim to represent younger people's point of view or their life experience, but I think history tells us that there are turning points, right? And of course, as we've discussed on Peak Prosperity many times in other contexts, there's the fourth turning kind of book and theory that every 80 years or so, every four generations, there is a existential crisis of some kind where the nation gets to choose its future path. And so I think we're coming up on that juncture, not just from the fourth turning, but just from all the issues that you and I and other guests have been discussing for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And so we're going to have an opportunity. And I think it's not going to be a thing where you break down the barricade and you enter the elite chamber and it's meet the new boss, same as the old boss. I think we all understand that's not the solution. What we need to do is decentralize, you know, wealth, power, capital. And that may require things that are far outside the mainstream. For instance, local currencies, instead of having a central currency, maybe we'll have a huge proliferation of local currencies, which will find their own value.
Well, yeah, and if those were actually tied to something of value in a way that made sense and weren't just simply decreed by fiat and under the control of a small group of unelected people, you could really make a case that the money system really should work for the people, not the other way around. But of course, when your money system is the thing driving the ship, it works wonderfully for the people who are at the top of that money heap, because they don't have to work and they can vacuum up almost all of the value that's created. And if they're not rapacious about it, they'll leave enough of that value back in the system so it'll perpetuate and keep going. If they overdo it, which seems to be the want of humans through history, if they overdo it, then they actually extract more value for the very top layers than is actually being produced. And that's where the rest of populations come in. It's clear to me that the elites have overdone it. Would you agree? And if so, how does that begin to reverse itself, given elites have a very poor track record of willingly letting go of anything, no matter how much they have under their control?
Right. Yeah, well, it's an excellent topic, Chris. And again, going back to our ecosystem kind of analogy, there's selective pressure, right, on all areas and of a complex system, right? And so what we're really talking about is the pressure, the selective pressure on the financial and political system is building, because it's not really adapting to the new economy or the hyper-connectivity of the world as it is now. It's basically trying to, the elites are clinging to this old structure of concentrating power and running it all from the top. And as that decays and fails, they're going to continue clinging to that. But eventually those systems break down, and then there's we could call it kind of like punctuated equilibrium, like the, in terms of evolutionary theory. At some point, the system, the ecosystem collapses, right? That, to use your analogy, the rabbit population is completely destroyed. And in our system, it could be the debt serfs. I mean, people just stop paying, right? There's no more debt serfs because everybody just defaulted. And so at that point, the foxes starve to death, and that would be the elites. And so, but all ecosystems rebuild with pieces that come in and adapt more successfully than the species and individuals who died out. Right. So I think we have a grand opportunity here to experiment, which is really what nature is. Right. It's a bunch of experiments go out there and respond to the adaptive selective pressures, and those that adapt quickest and most effectively succeed and occupy the niche, and those experiments that didn't work pass away. So I think we could look forward to that as maybe like this gigantic mix of experiments going forward as the current system decays and collapses. There will be ideas that pop up, groups that pop up, and we're just going to maybe have a free-for-all in which the niches which have been emptied of centralized power, those ecosystems will now be available to a much broader range of ideas and interests. So that's my hope.
Well, that's a wonderful hope to have, and I love concrete examples, so I want to just turn to what's happening in the markets today. This is November 28th, so for those listening to this later on in the week, today the Fed Chairman Powell spoke, left a couple of key words out and added a couple new ones in, so whatever the signals were that came from the Oracle of Delphi, that's happening here, and the market's just beyond excited. The Dow Jones is up nearly 550 points at the time of this recording. This feels to me a little bit like something what we were just talking about. Look, the Dow was down a few percent, not even 10%, and the Fed had just started a rate hiking campaign, and which didn't even actually withdraw liquidity from the markets. And even being down just a few percent, there was political pressure from Trump on Powell to stop that. There was people complaining all over Wall Street because the pain was just too much to bear being down. Not even an ordinary correction amount. A little bit of volatility, and the Fed already feels the pressure of the elites to step back and put a put on the market, assure it can't fall anymore, and get those excited animal spirits. They're really defending something here that feels indefensible to me, which is the concentration of wealth, which is the idea, dumb as it is, that stocks have to always go up in price, which is that the Fed is even responsible for these things in the first place. A lot of ways that I see failings in this, but this is our system now. It really feels very out of control to me. Like there's really not much of a vote to be had from my standpoint here. But this really feels like just today is almost a perfect example of what you're talking about in this book, about how these the elites are clinging to their outdated ways.
Right. And there's a great phrase which captures part of what we're trying to describe here, which is good ideas don't need force. And in the book, I describe the difference between force and power, because those are often conflated, you know, like in other words, well, what's power? It's the power to force somebody to do something. But that's really force. Power is like you win people's voluntary kind of cooperation. That's real power. And so we've lost, I think the United States has certainly lost it, and it may be a global phenomenon of all centralized authorities, is the idea is that we can force everybody to follow these rules, and we can force the system to act like we want it to act. And that is hubris, and all complex systems, you know, have basically show that you can't hijack a system and force it to do specific things to benefit like a few at the top of the heap, right? And so what I'm kind of proposing is, instead of trying to force the system to keep doing what works for those at the top, that we seek ideas that are powerful by persuading people to cooperate, because it benefits not only them but the common good as well. And that's really the human instinct is that we do understand. We want to do well for ourselves, but we also realize it has to work for everyone else too.
Yeah, and so in terms of beginning to get to the conclusion of this, which is, you know, what can an individual do? You know, what is it that needs to really happen here? What is it that you're really asking people to consider as individual courses of action here, given all this?
Yeah, you know, Chris, it's I have written other books that had more specific agendas like that, personal agendas, and this book is a little light on that. It's more like I guess the conclusion at this kind of higher systemic level is to ask people to understand that you're not going to be able to reform the current system as it's structured, and that we're going to have to radically decentralize, you know, power, wealth, and capital, and we're going to have to open the door, so to speak, to a bunch of experimentation to find out what works best. And so I think it's actually just asking people to develop those values. And I think that those values will be the ones that are adaptive and flexible and most likely to bring personal success, community success, you know, to those people that hold those values and understand that that's the future. The specifics of that is, of course, whatever adds to your own adaptability and flexibility and resilience is what you want to keep doing. You know, you want to build resilience, flexibility, and adaptability. So you want to keep, you want to have buffers, so you're not like, you know, always on a wafer thin, close to collapse yourself, right, or your household, and you want to build buffers of you know, food, wealth, essentials, you know. And skill sets, and you want to be able to engage positively with other people. As you say, our sense of how to engage people productively as it's been narrowed down to you work for a corporation, which is a hierarchy and tells you what to do, and that's our engagement, and that's obviously dysfunctional. So, yeah, just develop the skills to productively engage people.
And be flexible, decentralized, sustainable, all of that, resilient. I love it, of course. These are the things that we've been advocating for a while, simply because, you know, if something is unsustainable. It'll either change or stop at some point in the future. And if you say that we have these systemic issues where, you know, these are structural systemic issues, they're not going to be reformed. They really need to be rebuilt. Well, if that's the case, then obviously the best way to hold and conduct oneself in the scheme of things there is to be resilient and to be flexible, because stuff's going to change. Hey, it's changing all around us right now. So with that, Charles, tell people, what's the best way for you for people to get a hold of your book?
Well, visit me at oftwominds.com. You can download the first section of the book is free as a PDF, and then you can order the book from Amazon, as dreadful as that may be. pop me an email and I'll send you a signed copy if we can work that way as well.
Fantastic. Well,
thank you so much, Chris, for letting me talk about the book and these systemic ideas.
Well, thank you. And thank you for wading into these incredibly important issues. And I agree, we do need to spend more time thinking about the larger picture stuff here, because I agree with you. We're not going to vote, tweak, reform, or otherwise slightly modify our way out of this. It's time to think big. So thank you for doing that.
My pleasure.